Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hi there and welcome to Explaining History Podcast, and today I'm going to be talking about how East Germany in the post-war era used the memory of Nazism and deep-seated discourses regarding fascism in order to develop a stable ideological vision of their new regime. One which enabled them to create all sorts of moral and political justifications for the new Stalinist state that was being constructed. The way in which the language of political resistance is used and manipulated after 1945 It draws upon much of the rhetoric of the left during the Weimar Germany era and the rhetoric of the exiled Communist Party during the Nazi era. During the Weimar era, an umbrella term for political activism on the left that opposed the Nazis was anti-fascism. And the war would later be described as the great anti-fascist struggle. The war between the USSR and Germany during from 1941 to 45 is interpreted as a democratic anti-fascist war. The communist USSR is referred to, and the new German Democratic Republic are both referred to as democratic nations. It is unquestionable within Stalinist discourse that a workers' state representing the people, because you know other offending classes have been eliminated or imprisoned or executed, must by dint be democratic, and any capitalist democracy is inherently undemocratic because it simply represents kind of oligarchic or plutarchic forces, plutocratic forces, right at the top. So communism is referred to as democracy. It is a democratic struggle against fascism, and therefore anyone criticising the Soviet Union and communist parties is by extension fascist. It is fascist to criticise the new GDR or the Soviet Union. And another fascist act is the placement of the Jews at the centre of the anti-fascist struggle, or to give the Jews, by dint of the Holocaust, centre stage in terms of victimhood. This is seen as a kind of a deeply reactionary thing to do in the German Democratic Republic. The purge of the communists, figures like Ernst Thälmann and the communist movement in general in 1933, after the Reichstag fire, takes Walter Ulbricht, and the a kind of a second tier figure within the German Communist Party, and places him with Wilhelm Pick at the highest at the highest levels. Walter Ulbricht was in he's in part of the leadership of the Communist Party in exile in Paris from 35 to 38 with Franz Dahlem and Paul Merker. And then after that, Ulbricht was in Moscow after having made various trips to Spain to enforce Stalinist policies on the German brigade in the German battalion in the International Brigade in the Spanish Civil War. Ulbricht managed to secure his control over the KPD, the German Communist Party, by demonstrating himself whilst in Moscow to be a Stalin loyalist. So Stalin, during the war particularly, looked to people like Ulbricht to be the future. And Pick, who was a contemporary of Rosa Luxemburg, later becomes president of the GDR, they are nothing if not prolific, and their writings, essays, articles form the kind of the very basis of discourse within the GDR, the kind of the canon of communist thinking. One theme that helps to define Nazism in the post-war era, or views of what Nazism had been, was the idea, and this is was an idea shared by the Soviet Union, that Nazism was really the attack dog of capitalism, that it wasn't in its own right a specific racial ideology. Instead, it was a tool used by the capitalist powers to be set loose on socialism in order to destroy the Soviet Union and to destroy everything that had happened from 1917 onwards. This is why the term Nazism was kind of airbrushed a little bit. Fascism is constantly referred to, German fascism particularly, to make the point that there are obviously national variants of fascism, Italian fascism, German fascism, Hungarian fascism, French fascism. All these things are part of one greater ideology, fascism, which doesn't have to, in the East German way of looking at it, a specifically racial element to it. It is simply an anti-communist ideology set up by the capitalist powers. Anti-Semitism or any other kind of racial element to Nazism was simply a strange aberration, an eccentricity. The GDR also tried to distance itself from its huge responsibility in the destruction of the Weimar Republic, its active efforts to undermine it, its refusal to make any kind of deal with the SPD to keep Hitler out. In fact, its deals with the Nazis in 1932 to undermine Brüning's government as much as possible. And also the vote of no confidence that the Nazis and the communists allied together in 1932 to bring down the government of Franz von Papen. As well as fascism, the key enemy in the post-war period, and obviously fascism has been vanquished, but the key existing enemy in the post-war period, both liberal democratic capitalism over the border and West German social democracy, the social democrats, are seen as the kind of revisionist and treacherous brand of socialism, the branch of socialism that was a kind of a poor interpretation of Marx's original ideas. And so this makes up a significant part of the worldview of the GDR. Because Ulbricht interpreted Nazism through the prism of class, the plight of the Jews doesn't fit very neatly into his worldview. It's something that the KPD, while in exile, didn't really want to discuss. And certainly when they're making propagandistic broadcasts back to Germany, when the Soviet Red Army is sweeping through Eastern Europe towards Germany, it's not addressed towards the Jews at all, nor does it mention them. It's addressed to generically to German resistors of fascism. This may have included the Jews, and certainly it's doubtful that Ulbricht was trying to deliberately exclude them. It was that any mention of the special plight of the Jews detracted from the class analysis of the causes of Nazism. And if it could be said that Nazism was something separate and different, it was a specifically racial ideology, then that would cause big questions over the causes of Nazism in the eyes of the GDR, in the eyes of Stalin, and it would not be seen as exclusively a kind of a sinister capitalist ploy. And that was the end goal, to keep that version of it in mind. And it helped to be, it was a useful nation-building tool after the war to say, look, this is, this, you know, the ruins that surround you really is the devastation that capitalism has wrought by giving you Adolf Hitler. The extent to which this was accepted, believed, taken on board by the German population in the East after 1945 is obviously doubtful. But these were the devices, the ideological devices that the state would use and would attempt to enforce. There are sometimes occasions to this rule. Wilhelm Pieck, for example, in his broadcasts in 1942 and 43, highlighted that things were happening to the Jews in Poland, and he was aware that hundreds of thousands of Jews, Jewish families, had been crammed into camps and previously to that into ghettos. But mainly, during these broadcasts, the focus is on the Nazis' crimes in Russia. He said there was no bestiality imaginable which the SS bloodhounds will not commit against the Russian people. As the Cold War began and developed, the Holocaust had a very difficult and problematic place within East German memory. There was a suspicion of Jews within the communist bloc in general. Not out of the racial anti-Semitism that had existed in Nazi Germany, though there was obviously within Russia and the Eastern Europe various degrees of residual anti-Semitism that had kind of always been there. But now there were, in nation states which were becoming progressively more ethnically homogenised due to the expulsions of Germans at the end of the war, the surviving Jews were far more identifiable due to their scarcity and far more vulnerable. And the question as to where they now fitted into a world that was becoming bipolar between the East and West was a very pressing one for the secret state security apparatus in the occupied zones of East Germany and in the Soviet Union. An old traditional German anti-Semitism that was quite similar to the Stalinist post-war anti-Semitism that developed was to do with an idea of cosmopolitanism, that Jews were neither one thing nor another. They were nationless, rootless people. They couldn't be loyal to anything, therefore they didn't fit in anywhere. And with the increasing Cold War paranoia.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Of the possibilities of espionage, of traitors and fifth columnists within, and the development of nation states based around the idea of external enemies and enemies within. Remember from the podcast I've done previously on the Soviet Union, the idea of enemies within, hiding behind masks and that sort of thing, was sort of inimical to Stalinism. Jews were obviously a very potent target now. However, anti-Semitism was to some degree in the thinking of the West, the East German regime, synonymous with Nazism. But there is obviously a useful get out there, because the official explanation for Nazism is that it is not a racial ideology. It is simply a battering ram of the capitalist classes. And this gave the East German regime the ability to persecute Jewish people, but do it without appearing to be synonymous with Nazism, without appearing to be as fascist as the fascists. One indication that problems for East German Jews, surviving East German Jews, was on the way, was the purging from party ranks of Paul Merker, who was a prominent Communist Party member, who had argued that the communists needed to have solidarity with the surviving Jews. And the difficulty that he finds himself in here is during the early phases of the Cold War, when the State of Israel is created, Israel falls neatly within to the Western camp. There is some wondering in 1948 in Washington which way Israel will go. It's not a given that Israel was automatically going to be a Western client state in the Middle East. That was unclear initially, but following this, Merkel's position becomes untenable. His sympathies for the Jews become a liability for him, and he was purged from the party ranks. Part of this was also about the likes of Ulbricht trying to distance the KPD, but the communist movement in general, and particularly his liege in Moscow, Stalin, from all sorts of inconvenient memories about the war and the necessary dealings with the Western allies, and the association with the Jews in East Germany with the Western powers, and the Jews in the Eastern Bloc with the Western powers, brought back uncomfortable memories for Stalin of his own dealings with the West, something that he wished to really marginalise and trivialise, because Stalin wanted to present the great patriotic anti-fascist war as almost a lone Soviet endeavour, and one that meant that one that had almost no involvement from Britain and the United States. While the Second World War had compromised the Soviet Union and compromised Stalin and made Stalin vulnerable to having all sorts of connections with the West, which were politically unfortunate. The Cold War was now going to be a kind of a purging, cleansing period, where the where this subversive contact would be wiped out. The purging of the cosmopolitans, as it's referred to, begins in the Soviet Union with the murder of leading Soviet Jew Soloman Mikhoels, and the purging of the Jewish Anti-Fascist Committee. But it has its own replica versions in across the Eastern Bloc. And the language of Stalinism becomes trained upon the Jews of Eastern Europe, the surviving Jews. In March 1949, an article on entitled "Uncovering the Plot of Bourgeois Cosmopolitanism" was published in Moscow and in the German language paper Neue Zeit, and it said that cosmopolitanism was a key element of reactionary bourgeois ideology and American imperialism. So the essence of cosmopolitanism seems to be a suspicion that Jews in Russia or East Germany are more likely to be loyal to the State of Israel than they are to the mother country that they're in, or indeed to the revolution or to the specific ideology. And this, of course, is a sinister American bourgeois capitalist ploy. Stalin, who thought there might be something in supporting a new Jewish state, and thought that perhaps this might be an outpost for the Soviet Union in the Middle East, is bitterly disappointed and becomes a long-term enemy of Israel, and his decision to back the states of Syria and Egypt is in no small part related to this. Ulbricht in 1949 picks up the baton of anti-cosmopolitanism and runs with it. He presents to the GDR a view of the world where America and Britain are responsible for the division of Germany, and their long-term plan is a violent imperialist war against the rest of Germany. And cosmopolitanism, which is obviously the code word for the Jews, but it can't be articulated in the same way, lest memories of Nazism resurface. Cosmopolitanism is alleged to be part of this sinister plot, and one needs to be on the lookout for cosmopolitans in our midst. It's not difficult to see where this new bout of anti-Semitism originates from. It has different sources from Nazi anti-Semitism. It's not particularly caused by the same sort of thinking of Hitler's racial and biological thinking, but more the kind of the in Cold War paranoias and insanities of Stalinism. The listeners, however, the audience, have amongst them many of the survivors of Nazism and those members of the regime that have survived and transitioned through to the GDR. The GDR hired a great many down on their luck secret policemen at the end of 1945, at the end of the war in 1945. The Soviet Union gave arrested Gestapo men and Sicherheitsdienst men a simple choice, working for the new regime or on the first train to Siberia. And there were a great many Gestapo men who quickly learned the ideas of Marx, Lenin and Stalin overnight. And they were relatively happy with this. Secret policemen are probably not so much bothered with ideology as they are interested in rules and power and being able to persecute and punish those who transgress. And these new members of the regime were in a particularly good position. there was an actual clampdown on questioning the Nazi past of people who were flooding into the regime to act as secret policemen and bureaucrats, to suggest openly that the new East German regime was actually becoming diluted. The very fascists it had been fighting against was treasonable. And so this topic of conversation was entirely dropped. So it's entirely possible that a great many former Nazis who found a role in the regime, once again persecuting Jews and others, couldn't quite believe their luck. In Marxist, Leninist, Stalinist discourse, cosmopolitanism was referred to as the ideal of the money man, thus once again resurrecting this anti-Semitic myth about the Jews and high finance. And whilst there were dissenting figures, two of the more significant members of the Communist Party, Paul Merker and Leo Zuckerman, who had been in exile in Mexico during the war, both returned home and argued that restitution should be made to the Jews, that good relations should be held with Israel. And when they were arrested, the question that's put to them is, why would a communist pay attention to these issues? Why, of all the things you are thinking about, is it these ones that you focus on? And that very question alone presents Merker and Zuckerman as being figures of inherent suspicion. Part of the kind of survival skill of communist parties from before the war, during and after, is the ability to abandon previously held positions, the ability to suddenly drop statements against popular fronts and then quickly form them, the ability to suddenly make friends with the Western allies or make non-aggression pacts with Hitler, and then suddenly after the war to endorse ideas which are not very dissimilar to those held by the Nazis anyway. To keep open concentration camps that the Nazis, such as Sachsenhausen, to employ former secret policemen and to use their methods to essentially be whatever the party needed to be in a given space of time, be that in the Soviet Union or in Germany. And as a result, the vulnerable and the exploitable and the victims and the particularly the survivors of the Holocaust already were always going to be in a very, very vulnerable situation with such a kind of a fickle and contrary force that was chiefly interested in maintaining its the veneer of ideological purity and, most importantly, in maintaining power and adherence to the paranoid diktats of Moscow. Anyway, I hope that's been useful for you. Bit of a rambly one today, but, you know, sometimes we've got to go around these complicated ideological cul-de-sacs that emerge and, you know, really try and explore them a bit. Anyway, I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast and, yeah, speak to you soon. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.